Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Kaiser Bloor. Welcome to the maiden voyage of the Cynica podcast, the first in what we hope will be a continuing series of podcasts focusing on China, on politics, international relations, economics, business, the internet, culture, and just about anything else under the sun. The plan here is to have some of the usual suspects from China's Anglophone blogosphere come on as guests, plus special guests who possess that rare thing, actual domain knowledge and expertise. So, first off, we'd like to thank David Lancashire and the folks at Pop Up Chinese, which is a terrific online Chinese language learning service, my personal favorite, based right here in Beijing. They've very generously given us use of their studio where we're sitting right now, and we'd also like to thank them for hosting the podcast here on their site. Joining me in the studio today are Jeremy Goldkorn, longtime Beijing resident and publisher of the blog danwei.org. Jeremy will be a regular here hosting the show as well. Also with me here in Beijing is Bill Bishop, a tech entrepreneur, founder of MarketWatch, former interpreter, and by my lights, the best English language Twitter user to follow on China. He tweets in the nom de tweet newbie. Newbie, of course. Bill recently began blogging again, also at digicha.com, digicha.com. So welcome, guys. How you doing?
Thanks, Kaiser.
Great. Thanks, Kaiser. Good to be here.
So this first podcast, actually, not surprisingly, is going to be devoted to the whole saga of Google in China, with the aim of sort of talking about some of the bigger issues surrounding the whole thing. But first, let's catch everyone up on what's happened just in very recent times. On Tuesday afternoon this week, it appeared that the other shoe had fallen, that all searches originating in China on google.com.hk and other Google sites were triggering a reset, no matter how innocuous the search words. You guys want to tell me what you think is actually going on here? Bill, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I think the media tech blogs reported that there was this RFA, three letters added into the search query string, which apparently at some point triggered something in the Chinese filtering system, although that happened a week ago and it only happened yesterday.
So RFA, of course, stands for
Radio Free Asia.
Right.
So maybe it was a coincidence. I think like a lot of us who lived in Beijing for a while, I think we no longer believe in coincidences. but until someone can get a comment from the people at the Great Firewall Center, I don't think anyone really is going to know what's going on.
And sure, they're not known for their frequent commenting on, censorship issues.
It's pretty opaque. So it's anyone's guess, as you're saying. Now, Google actually did come out and make a statement, right? A couple of people that we know, Tanya Brannigan, the New York Times, they all spoke to Google, and they were told, I think, if I'm understanding it correctly, that this was sort of a glitch, that it was triggered by this addition of those letters into the search string.
But then they later came out and said that that wasn't the case. I think there were two separate statements,
right,
and the later one seemed to indicate that that wasn't the case.
Because they did it a week ago, and only yesterday did it start causing them problems.
Okay, right. So the mystery deepens. In any case, as of right now, it seems that it's once again available. You're able to do at least the innocuous searches on Google properties outside of China and not hit that reset. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I guess most of us have probably read now the MIT economist Huang Yasheng's piece, his op-ed in the Washington Post a couple of days ago. He notes that, or he makes the case anyway, that the cause of internet freedom would have been better served in China if Google had stayed, that the internet in China is actually quite vibrant and surprisingly free, well, much more free than Sergey Brin depicts it anyway. He cites the cases that I think we're all familiar with, Deng Yujiao and Zhou Jiugeng, as examples
a netizenry that's been empowered. What do you make of this argument? Do you think there's anything to it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think I've always been saying that the Chinese internet is more vibrant and freer than a lot of people in the West give it credit for. But what I don't know is if this is a sufficient grounds for saying that Google did something wrong by pulling out, because to me, there is one very noticeable fact that is since January, when Google first raised this issue, you can see in state-owned media and in government statements an explicit reference to censorship. In the past, this was very, very difficult to hear from
government
officials.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just said it was open, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's been some progress definitely by raising at least the issue. Now they're admitting that this is something that they do, and they're speaking sort of in defense of their policy.
Exactly.
Right. A lot of people actually were critical about Huang's piece. He seemed to have sort of gotten off track. He started off saying something that he didn't – a thought that he didn't quite follow through on. So what actually does Google have to do with this increased vibrancy of the Chinese internet? Do you think that Google really was a contributing factor to what we've described, to this sort of rise of the internet as a de facto public sphere?
I'm actually not sure, because one thing Google never did here was offer things like BBS services or anything like a Baidu Hi kind of, or a QQ kind of personal space.
Not even blogging, right?
They don't even blogging, because they didn't want to take any personal information. So I think all of these things that you're talking about, like the Deng Yuzhao case, you know, they all occurred on BBSs, where Google maybe indirectly is a player through their investment in Tianya, but otherwise I'm not sure that they actually played much of a role in that.
Right. They were an investor in Tianya, or they still are. They still are a stakeholder in Tianya. Jeremy, we keep talking about this Deng Yuzhao case. I think it's probably a good idea if we explain a little bit about what the background of that is.
So this was one of the sort of landmark cases of internet activism in China that happened last year. Basically, a woman who worked in a hotel was doing some laundry next to the sauna, as I understand it, or the massage room, and she was molested, and she was frightened of being raped by some kind of provincial government official, and she fought back, and she ended up stabbing him, killing him, and she was arrested and looked like she was going to get done for murder. And the internet, the Chinese internet, was outraged because they felt that this was a corrupt government official who tried to rape her, and it was self-defense. And most people attribute the internet activism, the internet outrage, to the fact that she got off without any punishment.
Right, right. I think there's pretty little doubt that it was the outrage netizenry that actually helped her get off the hook. Pretty much scot-free, as I understand it. Although, Bill, you've seen just in very recent days, I remember you forwarded me something from your RSS feed that suggested that there's now sort of a crackdown on.
Well, there was a Women's Law Center affiliate with Peking University that
four groups actually at the front.
Right, but one of them specifically that apparently has lost its affiliation with Peking University. Unclear exactly why the Taijing article's implication, or the Taixin's article implication, was that it may have had something to do with their fairly vigorous activism in defense of Deng Yuzhao when the case happened. I think that's more of an inference and speculation at this point.
Just hopping back very quickly to what we were just talking about. Do you think, Jeremy, that Google actually was contributing to this vibrancy of the internet? Do you think that it had more than a just sort of psychological effect of giving the netizenry a sense of connectedness to the global internet?
I think it's a psychological effect. I think in the long term, sure, having a major global player operating here definitely contributes to the vibrancy, at least, of the internet economy. But I think Bill is right that the cases that were mentioned in that article, Google had nothing to do with. And the internet culture of activism in China has very much grown up on Chinese websites.
And look at another example, right? That great Machime video about the war of internet addiction.
Yeah, Machinima video,
the Wang Yin Zhanzheng, where that was all about gaming and World of Warcraft, and actually really very little to do with Google.
Let's fill this in a little bit. In January, I believe it was, there was a user-generated video that went up onto Tudou and on Youku and a few other sites that was made by players of World of Warcraft, led by a guy who uses the nom de guerre, corn dog, is that correct?
Sexy corn.
Yes. Xingan Yumi.
No relation.
Xingan Yumi. Oh, he's your brother. So we have Jin Yumi and Sexy Yumi. What they did was they put out an hour-long machinima, which is an animation that or a movie that's sort of shot within the World of Warcraft environment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's using all the in-game footage.
Right, and I think what was interesting about this is that it just sort of used this whole war against internet addiction that's being waged as sort of a way to attack censorship in general, right?
Right. Well, it was the war against internet addiction, as well as the problems that World of Warcraft had. It was actually, you know, taken offline for about two and a half months last summer.
That's right.
Over some licensing re-licensing issues in China. And so it was a very looked at the year in the history of the Chinese internet in 2009, and all talked about a lot of these incidents. And I'm not sure, was Google even really part of it?
No, Google really wasn't mentioned much at all in there, or if at all, by my recollection. If anyone wants to read more about this, there's a terrific post. This is actually where I first learned about it, on Bill's blog, digicha.com. He did a great write-up. There's also a write-up that I did along with my colleague at Yoku about this, and you can find that on buzz.yoku.com. Anyway,
enough. You're not going to plug my site?
Have you written about it? Have you?
I think, actually.
Let's move on. It's fine.
Okay, right. A lacuna on Danway, a rare lacuna. Do you buy this idea anyway that Google, in their decision to decamp, has in some sense abandoned the Chinese internet user, left them sort of high and dry? What's the impact of their actual leaving on the internet user, the average internet user in China?
I must say, I find it difficult to have sympathy with that point of view. I mean, if the Chinese internet users feel abandoned, then go out on the streets and protest internet censorship. It's not Google's job to defend them.
Right.
You know, have they abandoned them? Well, they faced a really tough environment. It's horrible doing internet business in China.
Absolutely.
You know, I don't blame them for leaving.
And again, you know, the majority of Chinese internet users abandoned Google already because they used Baidu.
Well, or either right? They abandoned or just never started using it.
So, you know, I think my circle of friends I've known in Beijing on and off for the last 20 years who are, you know, they're not the quote intelligentsia, but they're educated, successful guys. You know, I had a couple dinners with them last week and a couple of them didn't even know they were gone. And the ones who did said, who cares? So we just used Baidu. Right. And so honestly, I'm you know, other than a lot of the people on Twitter,
right? So
I'm not sure how, you know, people have a lot of other stresses in their lives in China. They have a lot of things going on, lots of opportunities, lots of challenges. And, you know, Google leaving isn't necessarily a good thing, but I'm not sure it's something that a lot of people wake up worrying about now.
Right. And I mean, do you get the sense that it's been sort of played up a little more? I mean, the impact has been played up more in the Western media than it reflects the reality here. I remember in the Guardian podcast the other day, Jeff Jarvis, who is a noted proponent of internet freedom, said in so many words, I think his exact words were, if Google didn't do this, it would never change, referring to the Chinese government and its views on censorship.
Well, you know, in the same podcast, Jeff Jarvis said something along the lines of, I don't mean to compare China to apartheid South Africa, but at some point, because of sanctions, the South Africans didn't have Coke, and now the Chinese won't have Google. Now, I grew up in apartheid South Africa at the height of the sanctions, and we were drinking Coke. So Jeff Jarvis is somebody whose information is not to be trusted.
Yeah, and also on that point, I mean, I just think, you know, well, I guess we're being pundits here, but the rise of this punditocracy, I mean, the reality is, you know, you look at the history of China and the history of the Western interaction with China. When has any Western person, government, or corporation ever been able to change China?
Right.
Right. And the simple idea that somehow Google can change China, I think, is rooted in some pretty deep Western arrogance.
They should read Jonathan Spencer's book on that subject.
Right.
I think it's called To Change China. Yeah. Right.
Right. Right. Or they could read Jim Mann's book on the subject on China fantasy. What about this idea that Google was intent on changing China in the first place? Was that really their goal when they came here 4 years ago? Were they trying to – was the object of their engagement the Chinese government or was it the Chinese internet user?
Well, I remember when they first came to China, the Wall Street Journal had a story where they had said they had seen an internal presentation, internal Google executive presentation where they talked about – one of the slides specifically addressed that issue and said that they hoped that by engaging – you know, they really believed in the engagement argument, that they hoped that by engaging with the Chinese internet and Chinese users that they would help expand civil society in China and help push more towards freedom in China. So I think, you know, it's clear they didn't say that publicly, they didn't tell the Chinese government, but I think internally that was at least one of the justifications that they were used to allow them to come in and make this compromise that they came in and agreed to filter sensor results.
Right.
I also think, I mean, no matter how cynical one may be about Google's motivations, I mean, a company that has a motto such as don't do evil certainly is going to have ideas about its place in the world as a force for good, not just as a profit-generating machine. So I don't see why we should doubt that they had ideas that this would help China or change China.
No, and Google, you know, when Google went public, you know, they set up, they have a dual-class shareholding structure. They're very explicit in their prospectus that they were not always going to run the company for maximum profit. So, they've from the day they became public, they made it very clear that they're not going to act. They don't want to necessarily act like the normal a normal corporation. They're
going
to take things other than profit into consideration when they run their business.
Nowadays, I mean, I think obviously we agree that Google was not set up to conduct diplomacy as a sovereign state, in spite of what Jeff Jarvis says in that podcast. I think he made reference to the idea that Google is acting as a sovereign state defending the internet against the encroachment
of
others.
Does Google have a military?
I believe they do, yes. I think it's ranked like third largest in the world after North Korea. In any case, one of the issues that I think, I've been raked over the coals for having said this in the first place. I've been now made the victim of attacks by trolls on the left, on the American left, the Chinese right. But I wonder, one of the things that's been really eating at me, is it beneficial for the cause of internet freedom in China to have the imprimatur of the American government on efforts to promote, say, circumvention technologies? We know that 9 days after Google's January 12th announcement, Hillary Clinton came out and made what she billed as a major policy speech, where she made clear in no uncertain terms that internet freedom is going to be a major plank of the Obama administration's foreign policy. Give me some of your thoughts on this. Do you think that the cause of internet freedom in China is actually well served by the timing and the content of Hillary Clinton's speech? Should the U.S. actively be funding things like circumvention technologies? I mean, they've earmarked, $35 million to support internet freedom. Do you think this is actually beneficial? Is it working at cross purposes? What are the possible pros and cons of this?
I think that the timing of Hillary Clinton's speech did not help Google coming 9 days after the announcement, because clearly, the Clinton speech, Secretary Clinton's speech, and the reference to Google, I think, played right into the thinking of some of the more security focused elements in the Chinese government, who clearly and have explicitly say that they see foreign plots and foreign threats over the internet, you know, everywhere. And so this just she just articulated exactly what they think. In terms of the U.S. government, I think that, you know, as part of our long history of foreign policy, you know, the U.S. government has always pursued or said that we pursue a foreign policy that includes a focus on expanding freedom and democracy and human rights. And so,
sure,
I think her speech fits very much into
core American values.
Core American foreign policy values and foreign policy rhetoric. Will it help in China? I don't think it will hurt. Will it have much of an impact? You know, it's hard to say. I think that in terms of circumvention technologies, why should the government will fund it, why wouldn't Google or other U.S. tech companies try and fund this themselves? Because but it doesn't have to be directed to China. There are plenty of countries that have filtering or censorship of the internet. And why wouldn't it be in the industry's interest to have some sort of consortium that just provides these tools that allows people in any country and people in any country who want to access the internet the ability to do it?
In fairness, the State Department didn't say that these tools were developed specifically for China. They were really for any internet censoring country. Jeremy, what do you think of this? Do you think that there's?
I think I broadly agree with Bill, although I don't know if that it doesn't do any harm. I mean, Chinese people individually and the Chinese government even more so, I mean, they hate being lectured by the West. And it does very much come across, I think, as a lecturing tone. I probably have more sympathy for this kind of thing than the average American, partly from, you know, growing up in apartheid South
Africa. Did we lecture you?
You do quite frequently.
That's a fair point. I should have clarified. I agree with Jeremy's point.
You know, I mean, just to say, apartheid was repugnant to me, and my family were liberals. They never supported in any way, and there was always the idea that we should run away and get out because the country was evil. Nonetheless, when we went abroad and we had people from Sweden or England or the United States lecturing us about apartheid, our first reaction was, well, you know what, sod off. What do you know about our place? Because, you know, often the people giving us a lecture weren't even that well informed. So I can really sympathize with the Chinese reaction of annoyance at this lecturing right. tone.
And I think, though, in terms of circumvention technologies, I think, again, I think if the U.S. government is going to pursue this, I think it's in the most effective way will not be to specifically target any countries. So it doesn't necessarily look like it's lecturing. It's just there are these tools out there. Here they are. You know, the problem the U.S. government has potentially, and as any government, there's always a level of hypocrisy. While Secretary Clinton is pushing this agenda and talking about circumvention technologies, the U.S. government is spying on WikiLeaks and trying to take them offline. And, you know, WikiLeaks, you could argue from a libertarian perspective, is sort of one of the last bastions of true freedom of information on the internet. At least some people would make that argument.
Right. I have trouble myself comparing the two. I mean, China's regime of censorship.
No, I'm not conflating the two. I'm not comparing it with China. My point, though, is that the U.S. government, to say we support these circumvention technologies to help people have free access to information, on the one hand, on the other hand, having the U.S. government trying to take offline certain websites like WikiLeaks.
Well, really,
potentially, you know, it leaves the U.S. government open to, I think, a fairly easy attack by, say, people in China and say, look how hypocritical you are.
Sure.
Which is one way the government will then be able to, I think, discredit that argument, at least through their censorship regime inside the country.
So assuming that we're all for the expansion of internet freedoms in China, and I think that's a fair assumption, just from a strategic point of view, one of the things that's very troubling to me, I know that I've talked to you guys both individually about this, is the very real possibility that the Falun Gong is going to get some of this money to fund whatever new iteration of Freegate is now in the works. Freegate, of course, was one of the more popular circumvention tools that was used in China that was developed by an ardent Falun Gong supporter. It's got the fingerprints of Falun Gong all over it. Do you think? I mean, my concern is like in the first round of funding that went off, there was a lot of criticism that came from the Falun Gong itself and from some of its friends on the Hill, suggesting that there had been sort of discrimination on religious grounds against this organization. Now, I don't believe in discriminating against anyone on religious grounds, certainly, but what's going to happen in the Chinese popular imagining when Falun Gong's fingerprints are all over?
Well, I mean, from what I can tell, a lot of people both in China and outside of it already believe that Falun Gong gets a lot of money from the U.S. government or the CIA. I think that's quite a popular belief already, so it will encourage that kind of belief. And, you know, to be honest, their funding is quite mysterious. One does wonder.
Right.
No, I mean, frankly, you mean Falun Gong's funding?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it would be a mistake to give the Falun Gong money for circumvention and technologies in China at this point. I think that the U.S. can find other groups to whom to give that money. Giving it to Falun Gong, I mean, China, the Falun Gong is one of those nuclear issues with the Chinese government. You know, the U.S. government has a very broad relationship with China. We have a lot of challenges in that relationship. And I think that we can achieve the same ends in terms of distributing circumvention technologies without necessarily sticking a finger in China's eyes, which is effectively what the U.S. government is doing by giving money to Falun Gong for circumvention technologies.
Well, it hasn't been done yet.
Hasn't been yet, but I think we have a very important relationship. We have a lot of challenges. It's a very difficult time in the world, and we have to pick our battles.
And giving money to a crazy cult run by a guy who believes in aliens and things is not maybe the best use of money.
Are you suggesting, because I mean, part of me thinks instead of giving the money, the U.S. government should actually audit them first.
Yeah, that would be nice. I'd like to see that. I mean, we do that with all the other loony cults, don't we? So actually, in this whole rush to praise Google, and I think, you know, much of what they've done is certainly worthy of some praise, I worry that actually people in the West aren't having a serious discussion that I really feel needs to be had about China's whole rationale for censorship, why it still seems to resonate with so many people within China, makes sense to so many people within China. I've actually met very few who think that the government should just simply stop trying to plug all the holes or should give up entirely on keeping the floodgates from flying open. I mean, should we be encouraging dropping a dam buster, or do you think that there's a case to be made for gradualism? What's happening in your mind? I know, Jeremy, your position is hardened, I think. I think you used to sort of cut the party a little more slack. Where are you now in the wake of Google? Has this changed anything for you?
Well, you know, I mean, my position hardening has probably got a lot to do with my own website being blocked. You know, that's very it's a daily reminder of an unpleasant fact of life in China, which is that, you know, information is not free here. I find it very difficult to find any kind of rationalization for the extreme control of the media and the internet that still exists in China.
Right.
Myself. But if the Chinese people don't want that to change, it's not going to change. And my take is that the people who are against internet censorship and other media controls in China is still a tiny minority. The proverbial man on the street doesn't seem to care. And if that doesn't change, I don't think anything will change.
But to your point earlier, I think that there may be more people now who are aware that there is censorship.
Yes,
whether or not that changes opinions. But again, it's not really. That's a tough question. Where you know, I have my beliefs. It's not. I'm an outsider. It's not in my position. I'm a guest in this country. It's not. No matter what I say, it doesn't matter. It's not going to change anything. And it's really not. You know, I don't want to come off as a preachy American.
Right, but you are in a position.
I mean, no, but I'm in a position to say that I think if you look at the issue from the perspective of the Communist Party and the way that they built the party and took power in China, ideological work, information control is paramount, and it's one of the core pillars of the party and how they rose to power and how they've kept power. So from the perspective of the party and all the right, you know, the theoretical writings they do, I mean, you can read a lot of stuff is published online. You can read it, and actually have read some of it, even though my brain gets a little numb sometimes. You know, they believe very, very deeply in the necessity to, you know, control information. Obviously, now the new term, I guess, is called guiding public opinion.
Right.
And in that case, I think one of the best places to read about this is actually the China Media Project run out of Hong Kong
University. David Mandursky,
David Mandursky is one of the smartest observers of what's going on in China.
Great stuff.
So here's a question then. I think that's true. You know, the founding principles, the founding operational methods of the Communist Party are very much include information control. Do you think it's something actually deep in Chinese culture itself? Because, I mean, the apocryphal story about Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor of China, one of his first acts upon unifying the country was to
burn the books and bury the scholars,
right? Is this something that's actually very Chinese, that information control is a part of Chinese culture? It's not just the communists.
I think it's just common to all pre-modern societies.
Right. I mean, you look at Tang Dynasty, not the band that Kaiser founded, but the actual dynasty.
Or that.
They actually were fairly open with information, weren't they?
Right, whereas the band actually was very, very, you know, restrictive.
That's a question for me. I mean, I certainly have seen some scholars who would argue that. I go back to, I think most people would prefer to be able to access whatever information they want. And if they don't know that they're missing something, then they're not unhappy.
Right. But of course,
freedom isn't free. I mean, you know, if they would prefer, but they're not prepared to do anything about it, nothing is going to change, which, right. I mean, comes back to my point that if Chinese people don't want this to change, it's not going to change.
But one of the things, I mean, back to the original discussion of things like the Deng Yijiao case, I think, you know, the Chinese government has obviously been very, very adept at adapting and staying in power. And I think one of the things that's been going on the internet, you know, it seems like they realized fairly late the destabilizing potential of the internet and the free flow of information. If you look over the last 18 months, I think we'd all say that there's been a fairly noticeable pulling back in of or increasing of control over the internet and over websites and over censorship. And I think, you know, stuff like the Deng Yijiao case, allowing internet opinion to sort of influence actions, as far as I know, they've influenced things at the margins. They've influenced or caused problems for officials who are really nobody really cared about. They were lower-level guys. It hasn't actually done anything at the core to make
any
changes.
I'm very much of two minds of it. I mean, if you look at the agenda of the CPPCC and the NPC just, you know, earlier this month, it seems like it was cribbed entirely off of BBSs. It seems like it was cribbed entirely off of discussion that was happening online. I'm of two minds. Well, first of all, you know, Deng Yijiao is not by any means the only case. Rarely does a week go by where we don't see a major sort of internet public opinion driven campaign. It had the power of turning regional
media
stories.
I mean, the big story right now is the vaccine.
Exactly, the vaccine thing.
How it's not no longer
the dead babies in Shandong or I mean, you'll see this happens now with everything that happens anywhere in China that has the power to make people feel indignant about it. Is this, though, taken or was it given? Is this something that the Chinese Communist Party has sort of cynically allowed to happen as a release of pressure? Or do you think this is something that by just sort of the will of the people was taken, you know, was staked out?
I think actually it was the party didn't understand the power of the internet. And so people took this space because no one was watching. And now that the government has started watching, they've really started to I think, take a very sophisticated approach to information management online. Again, don't send me nasty emails saying I support this. I'm just trying to explain how the party may be looking at these issues. But I think that now the way this whole concept of guiding public opinion, I think actually is part of it is deeply rooted in trying to figure out how to let off steam. While at the same time, you know, if you think of it as an engine, you can let off steam on the sides, but you're actually hardening the core. And I think you can see this sort of hardening of the basic concepts or basic attitudes towards control in China, while on the margins they let stuff happen. And that, you know, that to me is when you talk about how does the internet, you know, what has it done to affect China and has it moved it closer to more of an open place? And, you know, was Google's presence here good? I mean, you look at the last 18 months, it seems like things have gotten tighter, even though Google was getting bigger.
Yeah, one thing maybe we should say, especially for people who don't live in China and aren't really familiar with the changes of the last 10 years. Just about 10 years ago, I was working for Bill's friend, Hong Huang, on a magazine, and it's a Chinese magazine. And we were censored by the Chinese partner who was responsible for the content and could get into trouble if we did things wrong. For one article, the headline of it was about games, internet games, and the headline was based on a Chinese proverb, a Chengyu, about how people have played games since ancient times. And she said, look, we can't have that because we're not playing games, we're building socialism. You don't see that kind of censorship anymore in the media or on the internet. So, you know, although the last 18 months, particularly the last 9-10 months, have been pretty horrible in terms of, you know, the tightening, you know, icy hand of the party around the neck of everyone who writes on the internet. If you go back 10 years,
it's dramatically improved.
Yeah.
It's dramatically improved.
And I think it was on a clear trajectory as of the end of 2007, but it seems to have been pretty badly derailed. Was this, a deliberate a move to adopt a different, more strict control, or was this sort of response to a series of ad hoc responses to a series of crises?
I think the crises accelerated what would be a tendency within sort of the more security focused elements in the party to try and rein in and sort of bring back more of the sort of control or ideological work. And then of course 2008 you had the Tibet,
right.
You had the Olympics,
right.
You had the earthquake. It was a pretty difficult year. And I think, you know, let's be honest, right, the IOC is, you know, the Chinese government has a lot to thank the IOC for, because the Olympics actually, you know, the great irony of ironies, I think contributed to a pretty significant hardware and software upgrade of the security services here.
Absolutely.
And, you know, of course, like any government or security service anywhere in the world, once you get new stuff, you're not going to stop using it.
What's your best guess as to what's coming next? Well, first of all, I mean, do you think that has anything surprised you in the government's response to this whole l'affaire Google surprised you? Has it been harder or less harsh than you had expected?
I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, I think they were kind of amazed that this happened at the time.
Yeah, and very much on their back foot about this.
They were on the back foot. It was pretty slow for that reason. But, you know, I was pretty amazed, too. I mean, I don't know of a single other foreign company who's done something like this.
Nothing like this. This is unprecedented. Absolutely. I can't think of a single parallel either.
Right. I mean, I think that – plus there are – it's such a big issue. There are lots of ministries involved. So I think they must have had a bunch of really interesting meetings where they all sort of looked around the table and tried to figure out, you know, what do we do? Because it's obviously such a sensitive topic. I think at the end of the day, I mean, most of the people I know who've worked in the internet in China – Chinese and foreigners, I don't think anyone was surprised at the outcome, because, I mean, I just don't think there was any chance that the Chinese government was going to change its laws for Google.
What's been the visible part of the actual – I mean, aside from allowing the sort of Xinhua editorial line to run rampant and to rein in any discussion about Google, it's positive, takes Google's perspective in this in the Chinese media, have they actually done anything in response? I mean, it doesn't seem that they've we're still not sure how to interpret what happened 24 hours ago, but what's going on in terms of actual responses, policy responses to Google? I've only seen statements in the press, nothing. I mean, if you look at what the foreign ministry spokesperson said, I thought it was pretty mild.
The Chinese, I think, took the high road. They just said, Google's welcome if they abide by our laws.
And insofar as there's a high road to be taken.
Right, exactly. I mean, but my point, I think the Chinese government actually was pretty restrained and sort of, I think sort of let Google twist for 9 weeks. And Google, I think, was surprised at the fact that they basically just kept walking into a wall. And so now, we've seen somewhat of a vilification campaign in the press, although it's not nearly as shrill as other vilification campaigns have been.
Yeah,
and so it's actually I know people who aren't used to looking at some of this Chinese propaganda statements were pretty shocked. I think actually it was on a 1 to 10 scale, it was probably like a 6.
Yeah, totally wrong.
Yeah, Chris Patton was an 11, right? But this was relatively restrained. It was pretty bad, but it was relatively restrained.
Yeah, totally wrong is much milder than devils and
prostitute exactly. For 1,000 years.
The Dalai Lama. Or,
yeah.
But I think now that they've left and at least Google insinuated or inferred or hinted that this was actually a compromise decision. It's been a week. I think things move slowly in the Chinese government, and there are lots of people, lots of groups and ministries that have to coordinate. I think what happens now, I would be shocked if it's sort of everybody's happily looking across the border in Hong Kong and everything goes forward as planned, except for Google search being out of China. I would expect other things to be done to Google's business in China over the next few months.
Prognostications, Jeremy?
I think it's not going to be easy for Google to make any money in China over the next year or two. I think they're going to find, particularly with large state-owned organizations, the telecom operators and stuff, I think they're going to find a lot of closed doors in their faces that used
absolutely.
To be open.
Yeah, right. They're not poison.
Yeah, I don't see any sort of really aggressive moves on the part of the Chinese state to try and crunch them or shut them out. But, you just have to ignore them and give them a frosty response and not open certain deals to them. And,
Jeremy's exactly. I think that's exactly right. I think the Chinese government's going to crack down. I just think they're going to. There's lots of things that can happen in the background that we'll never know about that you can't actually say, oh, this was a government mandate. But like you said, all of a sudden, advertisers have to leave, partnerships dry up.
That
stuff
is always the case here, right?
Right. And you sort of know what happened, but you don't know what happened and you can't prove it.
And some of the time, it's not even, it really isn't the government. And I mean, you can see this kind of effect even in the expatriate business community. I mean, I was sort of disinvited from a foreign chamber of commerce panel discussion shortly after my website was blocked because one of the panelists alleged that I was too political. Business people in China are very averse to politics, and I can see that it may not even have anything to do with the government, but there may be companies who just decide they don't want anything to do with the troublemaker.
Which is from a business perspective,
one can understand.
It's very understandable.
Well, anyway, I am very eager to move on next week to a new batch of topics. Hopefully nothing will blow up in the next week and we can actually talk about a couple of topics that are wholly unrelated to Google. Imagine that. So anyway, thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this first installment of the Seneca podcast. Again, I'd like to thank David Lancashire and PopUpChinese.com. PopUpChinese.com. Check it out. Check out their Firefox browser plugin. Totally terrific if you're a learner of Mandarin. They've got all sorts of nifty tools if you're learning Chinese. Thanks to Bill Bishop and to Jeremy Goldcorn for joining me, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks.